Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Mark Clovis, your host for the channel. Today, I'm speaking with Anthony Kaldelis about his book, Roman Land, Ethnicity and Empire in Byzantium. Anthony, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Mark. It's a pleasure to be back on your podcast again.
And it's a pleasure to have you again, especially with a book as interesting as this one. I was wondering, for listeners who aren't familiar with our previous podcast, I was wondering if you could tell them something about yourself.
Sure. Well, I am a professor of classics at The Ohio State University in Columbus, Ohio. I have been here now for 20 years, and yet my degree is in history from the University of Michigan. So I'm a PhD in history, Byzantine history specifically. So I am among very, very few Byzantinists who have a position in a department of classics. So most of my colleagues study ancient literature and ancient religion and so on. Scholars of Byzantium are in history departments or art history departments. But that's what I do. So I teach courses in history, in classics, in Greek of all periods. I don't teach modern Greek. I speak it.
It's interesting because I feel as though that plays well into what you write about in the book. And it's a very interesting book. And I compare with the previous book we talked about, which was Streams of Gold, Rivers of Blood, which was a history of a specific period in what we call the Byzantine Empire. And yet Romanland looks at the empire from a very different perspective. What was it that led you to focus upon this subject of ethnicity and the idea of empire in the East?
Actually, this book, Romanland, it stems directly from the research that I did for Streams of Gold in the following sense. The period of Byzantine history that I narrated and analyzed in the previous book was a period when Byzantium, in the 10th century, sort of rapidly expands. It conquers a whole host of territories in Syria, in Armenia, in the Caucasus, but also in the Balkans, especially the Bulgarian Empire. And so it expands and becomes much more imperial. And then in the later 11th century, it loses a lot of this, especially in the east. So all the Caucasian the territories in the Caucasus and then Asia Minor. So in looking at this process, I became fascinated at the question of empire. What does it mean for a state to go from being less imperial, right, in the relations between the rulers and the ruled, to being more imperial and more diverse in terms of languages and ethnicities and so on? How did the Byzantines handle this? And at that point, I realized that in my field, Byzantine studies, there really isn't sustained attention to those questions of empire and ethnicity, which you would think are kind of crucial, right, for discussing empire. And as it happens, there is a flourishing bibliography on empire going on all around Byzantium. That is, in antiquity, they talk about ancient empires, medieval empires, modern empires, and political scientists are involved. And so there's this flourishing bibliography and theoretical study of empire. And it can take all kinds of directions, right? It can be economic, territorial, religious, but a lot of it is about ethnicity. And you know how sometimes religious differences can be expressed in ethnic terms and vice versa, right? So those two are kind of linked sometimes. And I thought, that's odd. I mean, why does my field not do this? Because we call Byzantium an empire all the time, right? Like that's the word that we use for it, the Byzantine Empire. And yet there's no definitions of what we mean by empire in that context. And if empires are multi-ethnic, and there's a sort of general understanding, consensus that empires are multi-ethnic by definition, what were the ethnicities of the Byzantine Empire? Like, this is never discussed either. And then I realized that there's no bibliography on ethnicity in Byzantium. And so that's where I realized that these two issues, ethnicity and empire, had to be sort of reconstituted from the ground up. And the ground for me is always the primary sources. So that's what this book does here. The Roman Land, it looks at the sources to understand how ethnicity was understood, who these groups were, and more importantly, how is their relationship expressed in imperial terms? That is, if one group has domination over another, what does that mean in practice?
And the conclusions you reach are really fascinating. I found as I was concluding the book is that you could sort of summarize it, to borrow from Voltaire, and say the Byzantine Empire was neither Byzantine nor an empire. I was wondering if you could perhaps elaborate a bit upon what you are arguing in the book and how it plays to the title of Roman Land.
Sure. So let's take each term in turn. Ethnicity let me start with empire, because it's a better framework for understanding the question. So empire is probably better to be understood not as an either or, that is a state an empire or is it not? And then the two don't overlap, right? Empire is probably better understood as a kind of relationship, right? Most empires are the product of conquest. So one group, whether it's defined ethnically or ethno-religiously, or is a kind of politically constituted, you know, body, either a nation or something like that, conquers a whole bunch of others. And you look at the historical existence of this state and you can see, well, these are the conquerors. This is how they ruled. These are the subjects. This is how they were ruled, right? But if you think about it, that kind of relationship can also exist in a kind of more or less degree, right? So you can have states that are more imperial, that is, they're characterized by those kinds of relationships more at some point in their history and less so in another point. And this is exactly what happens to Byzantium during its long history. And Byzantium, you know, like lasts 1,200 years, right? So there's an ebb and flow in terms of how imperial it is. And so that's one thing. Imperial is a relationship, not the essence of a state. I'll give you another example. Ancient Athens. We call ancient Athens a democracy, right? In the classical period, it's a democracy. We know how it was ruled. It was ruled very democratically through direct participation of adult male citizens, right? Nevertheless, ancient Athens also had an empire. It had an empire over other Greek cities, states. And so there was this dual relationship going on, right? It was the same with ancient Rome, right? The Republic. The Republic is governed at home as a republic, but it's the one that creates the Roman Empire, right? And so this is where our terms are kind of mismatched, right? If you think about it, we call it the Roman Republic, but it was more imperialistic than the Roman Empire, right? Once we have emperors like after Augustus, the empire becomes less imperialistic in terms of like conquering foreign peoples. And it actually over time tends to reduce and eventually abolish the legal distinction between conquerors and conquered. So our conventional terms for republic and empire don't really help there. But anyway, I just wanted to get across that empire is a relationship. So sometimes we have a state that can be more imperialistic or less imperialistic. And so the question then is, well, how do we decide that? Well, so empirically, it has to do with the relations between the core, the metropole, right, the ruling group, and its subjects. And so this is where I turn to Byzantium, sort of looking at the evidence. So let's see, who are these people? Well, there's a reason why this has never been discussed in these terms. And the reason is that if you look at the sources, it becomes very quickly clear who these people are. They're named in the sources. There's no ambiguity about it. The problem is, however, that the ruling group, the core, are the Romans. This is what they're called, right? This is what Byzantium calls itself. It calls itself Roman land, the land of the Romans. And the Romans are by far the largest group in the state. The ruling class are Romans. The dominant ethno-linguistic and religious identity of the population is understood as Roman. And this is a problem because there's been a long history of denying this in a lot of Western scholarship, or in most scholarship, for reasons that have to do with the history of the West, like medieval and post-medieval, modern, and so on. Roman.
You trace it all the way back to the 8th century CE. We're talking about an argument here that has been made in various forms for 1700 years.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, it starts in force in the late 8th century, certainly with Charlemagne's coronation, and then you have the emergence of institutions like the papacy and the German emperors in the West, and they have the projects to label themselves Roman, to appropriate the legacy of ancient Rome, to give themselves legitimacy and prestige, and they do that. And for a while, Byzantium can ignore them. I mean, they were, Western Europe was a kind of backwater for many centuries. But eventually the tide turned, you have the Crusades, Byzantium is conquered, it disappears. And this Western view of who is Roman and who is not, this kind of idea that, to be Roman, you have to speak Latin or be Catholic or live in the city of Rome or something like that, it sort of becomes dominant and ingrained in Western perceptions. And so what this meant is that they couldn't call the Eastern Romans, they couldn't call them Romans. It didn't fit the paradigm. And so you have this history of denial that starts in the Middle Ages. And instead of calling them Romans, they call them Greeks from like the language or whatever. And that persisted until the 19th century. And the 19th century was another turning point when the term Greek became problematic, that is to use for the Byzantine, for what we call the Byzantine Empire, for a number of reasons. We can get into them if you want, but they're very modern. And so that at that point in the 19th century, when referring to the Empire of the Greeks was problematic for reasons that had to do with great power politics and so on, the term Byzantium and Byzantine were kind of brought out of the warehouse of storage and pressed into service, right, to talk about this medieval state. And the idea was that, they certainly weren't Romans. We don't want to call them like ethnic or national Greeks anymore. We'll just call them Byzantines, which is kind of like an abstract, it's kind of an empty term. Like, it doesn't really mean anything. And the only thing that was left was Orthodoxy, right? Christian Orthodoxy, the Orthodox Church. And so that, for the 20th century, that became the dominant paradigm for discussing it. But within that context, it was impossible really to talk about ethnicity. That is, if you understand Byzantium as a kind of Orthodox empire and not one that's structured around legal or ethnic distinctions, then you lose sight of those. You don't see them. And so that's, in a nutshell, why my field doesn't have a developed sense of either empire or ethnicity. And I think they're perfectly valid categories to discuss, and that's what this book tries to do.
I'd like to focus for a few minutes upon that idea of the Roman identity, and because I thought your discussion on it was absolutely fascinating. The idea of how, in effect, there's this identity that existed that they acknowledged that mattered to them, that we have largely written out of so much of our understanding in the West of who these people were and in their own definition of themselves.
Yes, well, it's really strange, though, isn't it? I mean, you have a highly literate civilization by medieval standards that produced an abundant literature and sources, and they're pretty clear, like consistently clear about who they think they are, and they are Romans. Now, they are Greek-speaking Romans, they are Orthodox Christian Romans, but nevertheless. As far as I know, mine is the only field of like historical research, one of whose fundamental axioms is to deny that identity. Like when you come across it in a source, you're supposed to say, oh, but this, they didn't really mean this, or they were deluding themselves, they weren't really that, or this was just a superficial label that they put on top of themselves to hide. So, you know, like these are weird moves, right? Mm-hmm. Like I don't know any other field where you do that, like where that's the operating principle of historical inquiry, to deny what your sources are telling you, right? And of course, I mean, there's a history of Western denialism there about this question, but there's also how we've talked about ethnicity in many fields until very recently, right? Like this idea that ethnicities are kind of primordial. The modern nations, right, have projected these kinds of ideas that their nations have always existed, and even if they moved around geographically, right? And so there's this weird consequence in Byzantine studies where you can talk about ethnic minorities in Byzantium if they still exist today, right? Like you can write articles about Jews in Byzantium and Armenians in Byzantium and Arabs in Byzantium, but you can't write about the ethnic majority, right? Mm-hmm. So there's no bibliography on ethnicity in general in Byzantium, because that is other than the individual group in which you're interested. You can write about Turks in Byzantium and Jews or whatever, but separately. That is, you can't do so within an overarching theory of what ethnicity was in Byzantium, because then you'd have to deal with the core group, the one that made up anything from 50 to 80% of the population, depending on its imperial scope right at that moment. So, yeah. Romanus is a problem.
Yeah, I was thinking about how that approach also tends to double down on this perception of Byzantium as an empire, because you're focusing upon this notion of the distinctions rather than the commonalities.
Yes. So if you have a state that is like 80% ethnically homogeneous, linguistically, ethnically, religiously, same institutions, same culture, same art in the churches, whatever, and they understand themselves that way, that is, they talk about themselves as being, well, we are Romans because of these things. 80%, and then maybe you have, let's say, hypothetically speaking, right, you have 20% minority groups. But that doesn't really look much like an empire, right? I mean, that it's weird. No other empire would be like that. That is, that you would define what it is as a historical society based on the minority. Now, if you're getting to 50-50, maybe, though there are modern nation states that are 50% ethnic majority, right? 50% minorities, right? So you can still use that model too. Anyway, this has to do with the categories that we use, like how we conceptualize historical societies. But again, Romanness is the problem here. That is, you just simply have to accept what people are telling you about who they are. And that is... the dominant approach to ethnicity since World War II, right? I mean, since we're no longer using race for these kinds of things, there's some sort of fixed essence, some sort of identity that doesn't change over time. Well, then we have to simply accept people or groups for who they say they are. And in this case, it's pretty straightforward. I mean, I don't have to perform acrobatics or some sort of, sleight of hand or something like that to show you that they thought they were Romans. It's just written all over the place.
So when we're talking about Romans, how do we identify them, or what are the distinctions and commonalities that exist in terms of this group?
Sure. So, wait, distinctions within the group or between it and other groups?
Between it and other groups.
Oh, yeah, right. They are basically the constitutive elements of any definition of ethnicity. And the sources talk about this all the time. In other words, they'll say about an individual or a particular group that, they were Romans. You can see this if you look at their language and the way they dress and their customs, that sort of thing. So in the book, I gather lots of sources that make these kinds of that point to the indicia, the signs by which you can tell what group someone belongs to. And they're pretty much those. They're not consistent because the sources aren't theorizing ethnicity, right? They're just kind of reflecting it. It's a combination of factors, language, religion, social customs, values, basically also the sense of belonging to the group of the Romans. It was very politically constituted too. In other words, the state, and this is a feature of Roman history from the very beginning, right? I mean, the Romans are not from the very beginning, right? They're not like the speakers of some language who are roaming around some territory, and if, maybe some warlord will create a state from them, then it will disband and something like that. No. The Romans from the very beginning are a politically constituted group in a res publica with laws and political authorities and so forth. And this is what Byzantium is. It's just a continuation of the ancient Roman state. And I should say here for your listeners, just because they might be confused, like who exactly are these Romans in Byzantium and why do they call themselves that? Because, the average person hears Roman and they think, I don't know, Julius Caesar or Scipio or Augustus, basically a Latin speaker from the city of Rome who lived in antiquity and was a pagan and so forth. Okay, So presumably that listener will also know that Rome created an empire around the Mediterranean and that empire lasted for a very, very long time. And it fell in the West in the 5th century. This is the famous fall of the Roman Empire. Now, the fall of the Roman Empire was only half the empire, right? It was the Western half. The Eastern half survived just fine. And that is what we call Byzantium. And it survived for another 1,000 years. It had its own capital, which was Constantinople or New Rome. It was created to be a kind of branch office of Rome in the East. And its subjects were all Roman citizens because by then the entire empire had been enfranchised, had been made Roman citizens, and they were participating in the government and so forth. So Byzantium is just simply the continuation of the Eastern Roman Empire. Even before the West fell, the majority of its inhabitants, well, free inhabitants, not slaves, were identified as Romans. By the middle Byzantine period, this had become an ethnic sense as well. That is not just political in the way in which one might be like an American citizen, right? But ethnicity is could be anything. In the middle Byzantine period, those two overlapped. So political Romanness and ethnic Romanness. If you find a Greek-speaking Christian Orthodox Roman counterintuitive, I would just ask the listener to think about how that might come about over the course of many, many centuries, right? Even Caesar was bilingual in Greek and Latin. Many ancient Romans were. There was never any requirement that one speak Latin in order to be a Roman, not legally, not in any way, really. So it was the ancient Romans who created this sense of extending Romanness. And they did it very successfully. The most successful place was in the territories of the Byzantine Empire, Asia Minor, for example, modern Turkey, and so forth.
And that's very fascinating because you're talking about places that had a histories of identities that were there when the Romans arrived and that they were engaging with. So what you're describing, this is another aspect of the book that I found very fascinating, was how you're talking about something that is both 1500 plus years in the past, and yet at the same time you're talking about something that is also very modern, which is this notion of identity and ethnicity, and it's very relevant in that sense, the sense of how do we define these things and the degree to which, the definitions that we use today or the ways in which we define today are, relevant in terms of understanding how they did so in the past and vice versa.
Exactly. There are fundamental questions about exclusion and inclusion at the heart of this, right? Because after all, if you can make people Romans, right? So the Romans conquered the Greek East, the Greece, Asia Minor, Syria, Egypt, and so forth. If you can take populations from there and through mostly positive incentives, make them identify with the Roman orders to the degree that they no longer call themselves Greeks, but Romans, right? I mean, that's pretty amazing. And this is how ethnicity is constructed, right? It emerges in a place through long-term historical processes. This didn't happen suddenly. But nevertheless, it was the product of policies and approaches. For example, just granting citizenship on equal terms to the point where, you know, you admit former conquered provincials, so descendants, right? Descendants of people you conquered enter your Senate as senators. They become your emperors, right? Like we have a Punic emperor in the late second century, Septimius Severus. This is a person who spoke Punic. That's Phoenician, right? That's a Semitic language related to Hebrew. And he became Roman emperor. Then you start getting emperors from the East, from the Balkans, from wherever. So the Roman imperial state was this amazing experiment in extending the franchise and inclusion. Now, having said that, let me be absolutely clear that the Roman Empire was created through violence, an incredible amount of bloody violence and plunder and enslavement. Like, I'm not trying to hide that, right? The Roman Empire had slaves, about, I don't know, 15% perhaps of the population were slaves. They weren't enfranchised. Who knows what they thought of all this? But I'm talking about a process of gradual inclusion that started among elite circles. That's why I mentioned senators and emperors, but it extended very far down, say, for example, through the army, right? And the Roman Imperial Army is like 500,000 people, plus their families. That's a lot of people who are sort of plugged into the whole system. And then, everyone is enfranchised. And there were certain mechanisms by which provincials could have a say in how the empire was run. Certainly the armies had a say. So these are a lot of people who had a say, and those mechanisms allowed them to identify with it. So let me give you a striking, just to show our modern listeners right, how weird this is. So like imagine if when the British Empire conquered India, instead of what happened, they granted full British citizen rights, right, to the entire population of India, and allowed the natives not just to have local offices, right, and rule over their own. That's imperial ethnic politics, right? But no, to come to London and join the House of Lords and eventually become kings and queens, right? It's like that. And with Byzantium, it gets even kind of weirder in the sense that, well, so imagine then if the British Empire created a duplicate London somewhere in India, just so that, you know, that part of the state could be represented with its own, it had its own capital and local authorities. And that led to a dissemination of British law and customs and identity and so forth. It's something like that. Right. So you can see how far removed it is from modern policies of empire.
Mm-hmm. You, I think, developed this very well when in your two chapters in the book where you discuss the dynamic of assimilation and absorption with these case studies. Now, I was wondering if you could perhaps elaborate upon those case studies and how they show this process underway.
Sure. So there were very many moments in the history of the Byzantine Empire, also in the Roman Empire, but let's stick with Byzantium, where foreign groups were either, well, a number of ways in which this can happen. Sometimes foreign groups would show up in fairly large numbers at the border and seek entry, either because they had perhaps lost a war outside the borders of the empire. So, for example, this happened in the 9th century, where there was some pretty serious warfare going on in the Abbasid Caliphate. And there was a group of Iranians in roughly Azerbaijan called the Kuramites, and they had lost a battle with the caliphate. It was a war. It was a long, bloody war. And they realized they were going to be exterminated, and so they just migrated to Byzantium. So these are non-Greek-speaking, non-Christian, Iranian soldiers. And for reasons we don't need to get into, the emperors were actually quite willing to accommodate them and bring them in. Now, on condition that they convert to Christianity, which they did, and then they were basically absorbed into the Roman army. Later on, they were distributed, they were like dispersed, because empires knew, the Roman Empire knew, that is a faster way to assimilate groups. So they were dispersed to the various provinces of the empire, but also the local women were required to marry them, basically. I don't know exactly how this was enforced, but we do know cases where it was. So they were married to local Roman women, and we know something about their history. This is in the 9th century. Eventually, this group, this was maybe about between 20 and 30,000 of them. And we hear about some of them and some of their descendants for about a century, then they stop being mentioned, presumably because they were absorbed and assimilated, right? That's remarkable. This could be done with Muslims as well. Now, again, they had to convert. Here's the thing. There's this law, this is from the 10th century, and it says if a Muslim captive of war, so think about this for a moment. This is someone who has been captured by the Roman armies, fighting, a war against Byzantium. Which could even be a religious war, like a jihad or something like that. So he's been captured. He's been taken to Byzantine territory where he's usually like enslaved, that is forced to work the land or whatever. If he converts, the state will give him land to own, like with a 5-year tax-free grace period, and some money, I think, just startup money and a pair of oxen. And if a Christian family marries their daughter to him, they also get a tax break. Try getting that through Washington, right? Okay, so it's not the same because, we would consider... So even like liberals today would consider that to be sort of culturally, it's called cultural genocide, right? I mean, you're asking a group to give up its identity, to give up its religion in order to be assimilated. So that wouldn't fly. That wouldn't fly on either side, right? Mm-hmm. But of course, the Byzantine Empire had no scruples about that sort of thing. They were always happy to receive power. If people were willing to play along, they were willing to absorb them. And this is how it worked in practice. There are a lot of groups with which this was done. So Slavs, Armenians, and so on. And some of them we can trace their history over the course of generations. Like you can see how they start out like Armenians from Armenia and how their descendants end up just mainstream Romans, right? So Greek-speaking, Byzantine Orthodox, self-identifying Romans, over the course of a few generations, right? That's how long it takes. And so it's a remarkable set of policies. So basically, if you were a Roman, you could very well have and be aware that you had a sort of ethnic background, ancestry, even though, and you might have some like affective memory of it or attachment to it, right? This happens with many sort of white ethnic groups in the United States today, right? So you're like, you're American and you're white, but you're, I don't know, there's a Polish, Italian, Greek, right, kind of background there. I've found some cases of that in Byzantium. They're quite interesting. And then there are groups who don't give up their identity or their religion. many Jewish groups, and others, depending on their size. So when the empire conquers large numbers of Bulgarians or Vlachs or whatever, those kinds of policies of assimilation don't work. But I think it's all, it's very interesting to consider from our modern standpoint.
What you've described up to this point has primarily focused upon this notion of Romanness and a Roman identity. And then in the final couple chapters of your book, you basically undertake, and I thought it was really fascinating, this ethnic inventory of empire. And what you what emerges from it is a very different understanding of the Roman Empire, in this period, than we have previously just simply assumed with labels like empire.
Yeah, so the term ethnic inventory occurred to me at one point. I don't know if that's sort of insensitive or anything, but maybe I actually got it from university administration. I'm the chair of a department, and there's this thing that we do annually, which is a teaching inventory. And it's how many courses each person taught. And maybe that kind of just stuck in my mind. But anyway, whatever. So, so the question occurred to me was, okay, so we keep talking about Byzantium as a multi-ethnic empire. So what are those ethnic groups? Why won't someone tell me what they are? Because nobody will. Like, I looked and I couldn't find anyone saying, well, here are the ethnic groups that make this a multi-ethnic empire. So you go to the sources, and I found them, and they're fairly easy to find. So I thought I would do that. I would make an ethnic inventory of the empire of Byzantium at two moments in its history. So roughly the early 10th century and then the mid 11th century. And because a period of imperial expansion had occurred in the meantime, right? So I expected those two inventories to look quite different, and they did. So what I do in those chapters is go through the different groups that we can identify as living within Byzantium at any one time, and not only to identify them, but also to try to understand how they were being ruled by the Romans as a different group, right? Because remember, that's the key criterion of empire, right? Is this group being treated differently because of who it is? Are there specific policies that regulate it, govern it? Are they excluded from certain things? And the 11th century standpoint is the more interesting one because it's a more diversely multi-ethnic state at that point. And I found a very wide range of approaches. There were ranging, for example, from groups that were basically left alone to manage their own affairs, so long as they provided some sort of tribute to the emperor or soldiers on demand, that sort of thing. But otherwise, you're in your mountains, you do whatever you want, don't bother us, but you're within our territory notionally, so pay us this tribute. I found groups. So by that point, there were also a number of Muslim communities in the empire, and they were also left to their own devices, so long as they sort of paid, taxes or tribute rather than taxes. And I think that those groups would have been very difficult for the empire to absorb, just because its whole legal structure was sort of interwoven with religion, And then there are all kinds of other groups in between, some which were heavily governed, that is, especially by fiscal, judicial institutions. But like, for example, the Bulgarians. So the Romans conquer the Bulgarians in 1018. How were the Bulgarians ruled after that? And what I found was, there was a lot of emphasis on taxation and drafting into the army, but it doesn't seem that the Bulgarian political class survived. The ones that were previously sort of dependent on the Bulgarian Tsar and his court. So that group seems to have been basically deprived of power or stripped of its resources. So that was a very different kind of approach. Of course, the Byzantines would have been very afraid of that class. The Bulgarians actually rebelled against the empire on at least three major occasions. So that's what those chapters do. They just kind of go through and sort of talk about how the different groups were governed. And that's where you get a glimpse of empire.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, there's some interesting, there's some good bibliography on Jews in Byzantium. Jews were in a sort of also kind of ambiguous position. They were treated as Roman citizens. There are laws that say, yeah, well, Jews are Roman citizens, except with regard to their religion, where they are subject to their own, the laws say priestly class, whatever. I don't think that the Christian lawgivers were particularly interested in how those matters were regulated. But here's the sort of interesting thing, is that what a Christian Roman regards as religion is not the same things, not right, as what a Jew might regard as religion. So, for example, when it comes to things like women and property or marriage, right? Marriage in the Roman tradition is a civil matter, right? It's two people just making an agreement. Not quite like that in the Jewish tradition. And so I found some scholarship that talked about how Jewish women in Byzantium, eventually they figured this out, that they would have more rights in the Roman courts than under the rabbis. And they went to the Roman courts to secure more property rights than they would have otherwise. And the courts said, yeah, sure. I mean, they granted your citizen, you can use this law to your advantage. And this was embarrassing to the rabbis. So you have like in medieval Jewish scholars are discussing, matters regarding women and so on. And they have to say, oh, except for the ones in Rome, the Roman ones who have these special rights. I thought it was very interesting.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've taken up a lot of your time, but before you go, could you tell us what you're working on now?
Sure. I'm writing a new history of Byzantium. A big one from the beginning. Well, I hope to the end. I've made my way starting with Constantine, the foundation of Constantinople. And I've reached the 7th century is what I'm working on right now. I think we need a new history of Byzantium. A detailed one, that's involved, not, yet another brief history or short history or concise history. We have lots of those. Something that's written from sources. So it's probably going to be in two volumes. There are 1,200 years to cover, so I think that's justified. I'm working on the early period, 7th century. I'm almost reaching the Arab conquests. But I'm also thinking about the other end of this story. So traditionally, Byzantium falls in 1453, right, when the Ottomans take Constantinople. Actually, we're speaking on the anniversary of that event, May 29th. And that's traditionally when Byzantine history ends. Now, you can extend it a few years more because there were some outposts of the empire in like the Peloponnese and Greece, or there was another offshoot of the Roman Empire at Trebizond on the Black Sea. Okay, but those last maybe another decade, not more than that. But I'm thinking now, so if the Romans of Byzantium are an ethnic group, and there's every indication that they were, that story, it continues under the Ottoman Empire. And I've been looking a lot into Ottoman sources, and they confirm this. So when Ottoman sources are talking about the ethnicities of their empire, the Romans are one of them, the Rum. And so even within the Orthodox communities, they'll talk about, well, they're Serbs and Bulgarians and Rum and Vlachs and so forth. That story does continue past the fall of the state. It's a very deeply entrenched ethnic identity that lasts until the 20th century, because the Ottoman Empire, it falls in the early 20th century. I don't think I'm going to write that history. I don't think I'll go that far. But right now I'm working on a new history.
Well, it sounds like a fascinating project and one that's going to be very involved too.
Yes, there are lots of sources, but I have been preparing for this for a very long time. I didn't know I was preparing for this, but it turns out I was. I kind of know where everything is. I know how to find things quickly enough. I had a trial run at doing this with Streams of Gold. So that was 10th, 11th centuries. And you know, I thought, you know, it's one of those things where you do it and you think, huh, okay, it looks, it seems like I can do this. So I'll do more. Anyway, and it's been a lot of fun. I'm trying to write it in a particular way. I want it to be both informative and fun. So I'm taking extra care with the prose. Actually, I spent a year thinking about when I had decided to write this, I was thinking, yeah, okay. So I was thinking about, you know, how do you organize a narrative? What sorts of things I want to focus on? What's the story that I want to tell and all that. But also, probably more than any other thing, I read about how to write narrative prose and different kinds of prose. Because I feel that scholarly prose is sometimes not very accessible or fun to read. And I wanted to make sure that I avoided those problems. So we'll see. You can read it when it comes out and tell me whether that succeeded.
Well, I definitely look forward to doing that. Anthony, thank you for taking some time out of your schedule to speak with us. I hope you have a wonderful day.
Thank you, Mark. It was my pleasure.